In this episode of Cube FM, I spoke with Federico Yetzi from Google Cloud about what it actually takes to serve open source language models at very high throughput on Kubernetes. We use his work on reaching 1 million output tokens per second with QN 3.5, VLLM, GKE Autopilot, and NVIDIA B200 GPUs as a starting point. Federico explained why inference performance is often constrained by memory capacity and bandwidth rather than raw compute, how model architecture and KV cache configuration affect throughput, and why representative benchmarking matters more than producing an impressive headline number. We also discussed the operational side, GPU availability, scaling across nodes, load generation bottlenecks, and why a simple Kubernetes service using round-robin routing outperformed a more specialized inference routing layer for this particular workload. Listen to the full episode for a practical breakdown of how Kubernetes, VLLM, GPU architecture, and careful performance engineering come together in large-scale AI inference. Kubernetes requests and limits are easy to guess and hard to get right. Set them too high and you waste capacity. Set them too low and you risk throttling, kills, or downtime. LearnCube has put together a free set of resources to help. A book, interactive calculators, and a cheat sheet for getting CPU and memory values right. You'll learn how to identify overallocated containers and decide what is worth changing safely. Download them at learncube.com/Kubernetes-rightsizing. Now, let's get into the episode with Federico.
You're tuned in to Cube FM.
Welcome to Cube FM. What three emerging Kubernetes tools are you keeping an eye on?
Hey, Bart. Okay, so it's quite interesting, actually. So personally speaking, I feel like the problem of distributed serving is not entirely solved. And I'm very much into LLMD or NVIDIA Dynamo, for instance. And of course, I mean, not strictly Kubernetes related, but VLLM, it's like the thing that I kind of nearly check almost daily. So VLLM, I'm sure we'll talk about it later. It's inference engine or inference server. It's where actually our models are running. Also super, super important for really, really large serving platforms, leader worker set. It's a custom CRD of Cube. It's been around since at least a year and a half, but it's still fun and super easy to set up and integrates natively with the Ray frameworks. Still, again, for another important one is actually QAU, or don't really know how to spell it, but it's a Kubernetes tool. Actually, this is so funny. So Cube was born out of like ephemeral pods and like ephemeral resources, of course, besides like traditional PVCs. And it's incredible that now there are so many interesting projects that are actually trying to that are recognizing the extreme value of Cube, but adding missing components, like for instance, mapping more static HPC-like resources in terms of placements, in terms of scheduling, in terms of allocation, in an environment that was originally not built with that thing in mind. And QAU, it's trying to solve that. And also another super recent technology that was GA'd, I think, in Cube 135. Is the in-pod pod resize, basically increasing CPU and memory on the fly on the same node. And again, as somebody who is in the industry since quite a few years, like OpenStack, in case somebody remembers it, that has been a struggle, a constant struggle that I think it was never, ever solved. And yeah, finally, Cube has it. Last but not least, this is something that Google has recently announced. It's called pod snapshotting, leveraging also the GPU memory allocation and leveraging the Cube checkpoint utilities. Basically, it's a way to take a snapshot of the pod and effectively allows for a super fast resume of those pods. This is super important. When you have very large when the time that it takes for an inference engine to spin up, it's it's usually kind of long because when an inference engine starts, you have the kernel compiles, you need to load the model weights into memory. And so it takes a little bit, a fair bit of time. And this tool, especially with the CUDA checkpoint integration, it's aiming at streamlining massively this process and shortening the time that it takes, basically. So it's less time wasted. But yeah, hope that's great for you.
It is. And Federico, for people who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit more about what you do and where you work?
Yes. So also from the t-shirt, probably people might be guessing, the folks watching us. So I'm a customer engineer at Google Cloud. I've been at Google since about 5 years at this point. Customer engineer, kind of a fancy name, but it's kind of a technical pre-sales role, very technical. I mean, being Google. I'm based in Italy, and I look after most of the digital native market in Italy. And customer engineers at Google sit at like this pivotal role between the more pre-sales aspects. I don't know, POC, requirement gathering, economical aspects, of course, of every single deals, but also looking after what happens once the customer have agreed to work with us, how they can literally effectively leverage our technology, how we can bring that thing to production. So we effectively follow both ends from the very beginning of the negotiations, in case there is no already relationship, to when actually the customer until the aspect when the customer actually goes to production, and supporting them all the way, connecting with PM, engineering, and so on. So it's
good.
Please, sorry.
It sounds like you're quite busy, and you know, in terms of your background, how did you first get into cloud native? Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. How did I get into cloud native? This is a kind of a funny story. So my background is in telecommunication. I did network function virtualization, or NFV, for a number of years, which was very much a data center and kind of cloud native, but not really to some extent. And at that time, I was living in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and I started actually more and more. I think it was around 2018. Around 2018, I started more and more seeing my teammates back then working with this thing called Kubernetes, which I heard about it, but I mean, I never had any practical experience. And it was at the time where actually the entire telecommunication industry was working on the new telco standard, the 5G, although was not official, was not standardized, as we used to say. 5G became like completely containerized and completely Kubernetes driven. It started in a weird way from an industry that is traditionally lives of not of very much of a cloud native thingy, because of the 5G standard again an influx, I would say, of really, really beautiful innovation, and that kind of changed me. But my background before then was again not as much cloud native as it of course is today. So that was quite a journey.
You know, it's no secret that the Kubernetes and cloud native ecosystem, it moves very quickly. How do you stay up to date with all the changes? What are the best resources for you to know about what's going on?
Okay, so my by far top rated one is Hacker News. Hacker News doesn't just cover Kubernetes, but in general, like tech news. And I'm following it through RSS feeds, and every single day I kind of have 1 hour every day to catch up with the news. It's usually in the morning, but in the morning I catch up living in Europe with what happened the day before in US most of the time. And yeah, over there are all the major tech news, and most of those are cloud native. Some of those are also Kube related. Depending on, of course, on the context. But yeah, Hacker News is my go-to way.
Very good. And Federico, if you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
I always, I'm kind of always late with the latest trend. So I was kind of, although I read a lot, although I spend time since ever, every single day catching up with the news, catching up with the news is different than actually playing with the latest technology. So, and I wasn't late with like Docker or virtualization or containerization, but because of like a business side of things, I was kind of late adopting and learning Kubernetes. So, and I remember back then actually playing with Kubernetes the hard way, the famous GitHub repo that for me at least was instrumental in learning like etcd and kubescheduler and everything else, or kind of everything else. So tip for myself is kind of not just dedicating time reading the news, but dedicating some serious time into learning the latest technologies whenever possible, of course.
All right. Now, as part of our monthly content discovery, we found an article that you wrote titled 1 million tokens per second, QN 3.5, 27. Oh, anyway, well, we'll get through the title in a second. A GK with P200 GPUs. That was a mouthful. So we want to take this a little bit further with a series of questions. So before we get into the million tokens per second result, let's establish the baseline. When someone serves an open source language model on Kubernetes, there is more involved than loading model files onto accelerators. What does a serving engine actually do? Give us some context.
Okay, so serving engine, as I was literally before during the introduction mentioning, first of all, there is not one serving engine. There are multiple options in the industry, especially in the open source community. I tend personally to like a lot the VLLM inference engine or serving engine, but there are others like SGLang, for instance. The inference engine is the component where the model weights are being loaded. More in the this is very important actually to mention. More in the consumer space, you have things like Llama, which became super super famous last year, and Llama CCP from Meta. So I said more consumer because on the enterprise side of things, usually you tend to reach to things like VLLM or SGLang or others. Anyways, so loading model weights, handling the hardware. I mean, GPUs or accelerator are there, but you need to load the model weight onto it. You need to compile the kernels or specialized mathematical operations to actually perform matrix multiplication and all the other operations that an inference engine is about to perform, like multi-token prediction and other things. Managing the cache, like or managing the KV cache, or in general, like the transformer architecture for large language models is kind of a beast, has so many moving parts or components, and all of it is running on hardware on the GPU side. I mean, besides, of course, like exposing the API, but that is not really a thing in the transformer. And all aspects of transformer are actually offloaded onto the GPU. So you need to program it. Then, of course, I mean, model weights are so large. I mean, they can be tens of gigabytes, but some open source models can even be hundreds of gigabytes or even shy of a terabyte of worth of data. So it needs to be downloaded somewhere, of course. I mean, there are several approaches to solve this problem, but in the most basic and fundamental way, it's just kind of a Git clone or pulling the data off of Hugging Face. And that also needs to happen. So you need to retrieve this data. So yeah, inference engine is effectively the thing you talk to and it's going to give you back an answer or tokens.
I think many teams out there assume higher throughput mostly comes from buying faster hardware. Your article tells a much more step-by-step story. What were you actually trying to improve when you started this experiment?
I feel like what I was aiming at the very beginning was, okay, let's establish kind of a baseline of performance. Like, what can we get off of this hardware that I have available for this specific project? And also, that was, I believe, was not really published or reported upstream. But I also tested other hardware. So ultimately, the hardware, strictly speaking, the hardware selection came down to, yeah, I have a bunch of requirements I have to meet from end customer. And working at Google Cloud, I don't have just the B200 Blackwell from NVIDIA. I have other GPUs available. So what are the ones that price performance wise can better answer the requirements? And then it became just, okay, how can I, what can I get off of those resources, physical resources, and then seeing if we are too far off from the target or at a reasonable distance that tuning and optimization can get us there.
And you ended up deciding on, you chose the 27 billion parameter QN model for this benchmark. Model choice affects memory use, context length, quality, throughput, and cost. What made this model a good fit for the experiment?
Okay. So this answer, it's going to be two parts. There is a more of a business-driven part and more of a kind of more tailored, more technical aspect.
Okay.
The business-driven answer is that I originally didn't make the model choice. The model choice was customer. A customer actually arrived with this model, Qwen 3.5, and I believe honestly that they have made a great choice, and we will get into the second part later on. But yeah, so the initial model selection, yeah. So we have internally established off of our team that Qwen 3.5 dense model 27B is actually the right choice for our needs. But going into more technical aspects, Qwen 3.5 27B dense version is actually extremely good at following instructions. And that was instrumental for the customer use case. So that is more of the technical aspect. So the choice was effectively, so this story that I wrote about needs to be plugged into a much, much bigger picture where actually there is a specific use case that has been solved, not just by me, but by a team of people. I was in charge of specific aspects, but ultimately it was like a business case. And again, Qwen 3.5 is particularly good at following instructions, and the model is expected to receive lots of content as part of system prompts or part of the initial prompt. And we needed a model good enough that wouldn't randomly hallucinate or anyways not follow instructions, right? So that was the reason for choosing it.
And the hardware in the article is the newer B200 generation. So instead of just thinking about accelerator count, you focused on memory capacity and memory bandwidth. What did that hardware change for inference serving?
So in the inference world, there is a fundamental concept called the roofline model. Basically, and this is actually something that I also realized not too long ago. I think there is a general understanding that nowadays we need faster or accelerators capable of processing more throughput. But in reality, what we need are accelerators that have the highest possible amount of memory and memory bandwidth, for one simple reason. So the inference phase of an LLM, it's divided into two phases. The inference of an LLM is divided into two phases: prefill and the code. The prefill part is the initial part when the prompt is being processed and it's merely compute bound. So the more parameters we have, the more matrix multiplication we need to perform. But that part is done once and at the beginning. The second part of the inference is called the code phase, where effectively tokens are generated one after another in a sequential phase, and per each token, the inference engine needs to read the model weights. So in case of a dense model, the full model weights. In case of a MOE, mixer of expertise model, just the amount of experts that needs to be read. So if we need to read 27 billion parameters at BF16, that more or less translates into 27 gigabyte worth of data, well, we need to read per each output token 27 gigabyte of data. So this means that we need to have the fastest possible memory bandwidth in our system, and that is instrumental. That also was the key reason for going for Blackwell B200 versus, for instance, Hopper H100, which are, don't get me wrong, amazing accelerator GPUs, but they simply lacked enough memory bandwidth and to some extent also memory capacity to arrive with a reasonable number of GPUs to the target of 1 million token per second, total output token per second, total token per second.
Mm-hmm. And you ran this on, not surprisingly, Google Kubernetes Engine Autopilot. That changes the operational model compared with managing accelerator node pools yourself. What did Autopilot make easier, and what still required planning?
Okay, so also here, kind of a twofold answer. So as a Googler, I have this incredible privilege to have access to Google Cloud, but I don't have access to an unlimited budget. So the same amount of money our customer pays, we are also charged to. I mean, they don't come off of my salary, thankfully. But we do have a budget that we have to respect. And this budget is quite tiny and very strict, especially, I mean, when we have GPUs or accelerators in the pictures. So for me, Autopilot is extremely good because it literally costs nothing. I don't throw away money just for a setup phase, for the configuration phase. Literally, it's a production ready platform from the get-go, and it takes minutes to set up and to configure. For the other aspects, what else needs to be taken into account during the planning phase? Well, it's GPU and accelerators in general, attainability. Blackwell are extremely unavailable resources.
So you ran this on Google Kubernetes Engine Autopilot. That changes the operational model compared with managing accelerator node pools yourself. What did Autopilot make easier, and what still required planning?
Okay, so I think also this one is going to be kind of a twofold answer. So as a Googler, I have this incredible privilege to have access to Google Cloud. I don't want to say with unlimited resources, but I mean, we have access to all Google Cloud products. But we also have a budget. We run on a very tight budget. So the incredible thing about Autopilot is that the entire platform, end-to-end, it's fully managed. And I don't waste time, meaning also money, because I'm on a budget, right? For the setup, the configuration, driver, whatever. The platform is literally production-ready from the get-go. And it takes minutes. It's a simple API call or a simple CLI command, gcloud, a container, create. So it's very, very simple. But what requires planning? Definitely what requires planning is accelerator attainability. So it's not easy at all to obtain the latest generation of accelerators like the B200s. Those are in scarce amounts. And yeah, that was kind of a significant challenge also for me during this test for this customer, ensuring the capacity just for the test. At Google Cloud, we have, let's say, several ways how a VM or resource can be spin up. That was not reported actually in the paper, but specifically for this work, I leverage on a concept called DWS Flex Start or Dynamic Workload Scheduler. It's basically a way to spin up resources for a fixed amount of time, specifically 7 days or up to 7 days, and then automatically resources are reclaimed. And in that way, I was able to ensure capacity. But yeah, the capacity planning, as is also called elsewhere, or in general, resource obtainability, it's kind of beyond technology, and it's extremely important, especially nowadays in the industry.
And your first major tuning decision was around how to spread work across the 8 accelerators on a node. And for people that are out there coming from distributed training, splitting one model across all accelerators can feel natural. What happened when you tried that approach?
Yes. So that is also, by the way, it's also called the tensor parallelism. And so one A4 node in Google Cloud has 8 B200 GPUs. So, and of course, the B200s are connected with NVLink 5, going top of my head, I think 1.8 symmetric terabyte per second of bandwidth. But the problem is that this model, Qwen 3.5, it's so small that the inference engine was wasting so much time synchronizing the 8 accelerators, the 8 GPUs, and that resulted in kind of poor performance. I think going on top of my head, I achieved something like 22,000 tokens per second, which was kind of almost nothing given the platform capabilities. And yeah, so first experience, not great, Bart, I have to say.
After that, you switched to running independent copies of the model instead of splitting one copy across the node. That's a different mental model for serving. And how did that change the system's behavior?
Yeah. So first of all, interconnect utilization or NVLink utilization dropped to zero because effectively running DP equal one, excuse me, DP equal 8, so one copy per accelerator, basically means that each accelerator takes care of its own model, and VLLM will take care about the routing about a request per each individual GPU. So interconnect utilization went to zero, and also surprisingly, because the stream processor were not wasting time waiting for the request coming from other accelerators. Also, let's say the CUDA core utilization dropped to zero, basically. And not only that, but the total time per output token dropped significantly. Latency, which is median latency per all the output tokens, and throughput improved, I believe, by threefold, from roughly 20k token per second to roughly 60. So that was very surprising also for me, because originally I was thinking, yeah, I mean, we have plenty enough bandwidth available, right, in the NVLink, but bandwidth, it's not important. The problem here is physics. It takes time to transmit data, and this is, you can see the same concept in traditional computing besides HPC or AI inference with IO waits. When CPU, it's literally burning CPU cycles waiting for the storage to provide the data, right? It's exactly the same concept. In this case, we don't have storage, it's interconnect, and the data, it's not actually data, but it's synchronization between the various engines. But yeah, so the CUDA cores of each card were waiting for the others, and they were literally wasting time because it takes time to send and receive this data.
The biggest single node breakthrough came from changing how token generation used cache and prediction. Without going too deep into every flag, what changed when you introduced those optimizations?
Yeah, so, okay. So I think the biggest leverage besides DP, data parallelism, actually came from MTP, multi-token prediction, That gave, I think, a boost of 50% order of magnitude. So effectively, VLLM was able to generate one token ahead of time with a success rate of between 80 and 90%. So very, very effective. Beyond more than one, it was just kind of a coin flip. It was 50%. So that was wasting resources. The other breakthrough actually came from memory management. As I mentioned earlier, we need not just fast memory, but we need a lot of memory. The model is small enough that it's not consuming much of the HBM available. But a KV cache, yes. And KV cache, and VLLM is going to reserve per each request the amount of expected to be reserved. And I think originally was roughly 128K tokens. And that was a significant waste in resources. So that involved actually understanding with the customer, okay, tell me on average, how many tokens are you expecting to have in input and in output? And that allowed to tune the max sequence length, I believe, to about 2K, to 248, which is, again, it's very, very specific for our use case. But that allowed to shrink effectively how much KV cache per request we need. And in turn, that translates to have more memory available for more requests to be processed in parallel. And at the same time, also quantization of the KV cache. Believe default is FP16 KV cache, and we went for FP8, which is basically lossless. Not myself, but somebody else in the team ran some evaluation benchmark. I didn't see any drop in quality. So we established, yeah, it's a perfectly reasonable way. Just with a single flag, double the amount of available memory for KV cache.
Benchmarking model serving is easy to get wrong because different prompt and response lengths stress different parts of the system. How did you structure the benchmark? And what should listeners check before comparing throughput numbers?
So this is so interesting because unfortunately, inference benchmarking to some extent, and don't get me, hopefully don't get me this in the wrong way, but inference benchmarking can be super misleading because there are so many parameters, so many aspects of the benchmark that can be tuned to have an incredible high number, an incredible result, but they might not be representative of your use case, of your situations, right? So again, I think understanding, having kind of a plan and a double check with the customer of what is your specific use case, what is the problem you're trying to solve, I feel is kind of instrumental. Also, specifically for this project, at the beginning we were working with a shared GPT dataset, which is a dataset coming from, I believe, originally ChatGPT through a Chrome and Firefox extension that would allow user to share their input prompt and output answer, and we were using that to have like a variety mix of pretty much any kind of all kind of possible conversation to ChatGPT, but then it turns out that that was not representative of what our customer was doing. So benchmarking in LLM is not like running spec CPU or other very specific benchmark. It's about really understanding and having a good understanding of okay, what are they trying to accomplish, and let's work on that. And let's try to reproduce that reproducibility and representativity of the benchmark with a third party, with a customer.
And when you first scaled across multiple nodes, the numbers didn't make a lot of sense. More servers did not automatically mean more throughput. So how did you discover where the limit really was?
That was super confusing. I think doubling the number of GPU or quadrupling it yield a much lower result, and that made no sense whatsoever. So I think this is so before Google Cloud, when I was in telecommunication, I was actually a performance engineer. And as a performance engineer, is like you need to have lots of tools in your arsenal to understand what is going on. It could be Perf, it could be Flame Graph, or it could be old school or top command to understand, okay, let's see the resource utilization where the benchmark is running. Because I was personally under the impression that, hey, VLLM bench, it's multi-thread, right? Must process all those requests in parallel. It's not going to be single-threaded resource, right? Wrong. It was a single-threaded resource. So what I was originally doing was, okay, yeah, I now need to run 1,000 requests in parallel. Let's go for 1,000 requests. And let's go for 2,000. Let's go for 8,000. But that was actually killing the benchmark and not stressing the nodes, because the benchmark is a single node. Just small caveat. This was all tested with VLLM O18 and O19. We are now at O22. So maybe in the past 2-3 months, the community specifically addressed this point. Actually, I'm very confident that they have. But back then, a few months ago, they were VLLM bench, basically single thread. And yeah, top command spotted immediately the issue.
And once that load generation issue was fixed, the system scaled horizontally. From a Kubernetes architecture point of view, what made the node per replica design work so well?
Yeah. By the way, I didn't mention in my earlier answer. So the way of fixing the benchmark was simply running multiple copies in parallel. So I wrote a very simple shell wrapper that would spin up several VLLM bench and then aggregate the final results. So that was easy enough. Also with some kind of warm-up point to make sure all models would be loaded in all the GPUs. Well, sometimes a very dumb, allow me to say, or a very simple approach, like a cluster IP, it's working perfectly well, or round-robin request. And I have to admit, I believe we achieved 96 or 97% of scaling or parallel efficiency. So moving from 8 to 12 nodes, excuse me, moving from 1 to 12 nodes, from 8 to 96 GPUs, again, 96 or 97 parallel efficiency with a simple round robin. And that was honestly quite impressive. Again, sometimes the kind of very, 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 very old Unix concept, KISS, keep it simple. There's another S for something else. But sometimes the simple approach is the winning one.
And for those out there who are not familiar with the acronym KISS, it can be keep it short and sweet or keep it simple, stupid. So you learn something new every day on KubeFM. Now, you compared the standard Kubernetes service approach with a specialized inference routing layer. Many people would expect the smarter routing layer to win. What did that comparison show?
So that comparison actually showed that depending on the type of traffic that you are running, simple approach is actually massively better. The APP endpoint picker, which is a component, a much larger component called Kubernetes Inference Gateway, it's kind of a smart load balancer. It's actually not a kind of, it is a smart load balancer for the inference era, which consider a number of metrics like request queues, KV cache utilization. But in our situation with the Qwen architecture and so on, basically we were dropping requests. We were having like something like 35, if I'm not mistaken, 35 percent of throughput drop compared to a simple round robin approach. But also here, on the Google Cloud reference architecture, which I have personally contributed, the inference gateway with the APP, the endpoint picker, is on the reference architecture. So that would be our official suggestion. But of course, there is in such a fast moving world like AI nowadays, it's super important actually to double check. And I don't want to say double check everything, but definitely double check many aspects that that you wouldn't otherwise. And because otherwise we would have been leaving kind of 35% on the table, performance on the table, which is kind of a big hit, right?
And your article, you use an insurance document processing example to make the benchmark more concrete. And for teams out there that are evaluating self-hosted inference, what kind of workload makes these numbers meaningful rather than just impressive?
Okay, so I kind of need to remove my hat from Google at this point speak as, I mean, in my humble opinion. I think coding. So, and especially not just chatbot, but agentic coding. If you're leveraging an open source harness like OpenCode, for instance, with some open source model weights that you can locally deploy, when you're doing agentic coding, you are generating a lot of token. And I mean, I personally, through my various subscriptions or usage of Gemini, I can literally generate millions of tokens during the coding session or the vibe coding session. And that is me alone. And I'm not a software engineer, and I'm not a software engineer full time. So I believe that is for people listening to us. So if you want to do vibe coding with your own hardware, own resources, I think probably you are not going to generate a million token per seconds, but probably you might be you might not be too far off. And especially in case you're leveraging like latest trends of loops and goals, when you have an agent working for you towards a certain goal, or if you're doing sentiment analysis of your product on Twitter and Reddit and Discord. This is also something that Anthropic recently disclosed with Boris, the creator of Cloud Code, explaining how, yeah, he always has something like, I think, 9,000 agents running in background to check all sorts of things. And I mean, in that case, you really need to have beefy hardware, and those numbers do make sense.
Looking back at the full journey, this was not just one clever trick. It was a sequence of measurements and fixes across serving, memory, load generation, routing, and operations. What advice would you give? Sorry, I have to say it again because I said routing one. I have to be consistent. Because in Spain, we say router. So that's the problem of learning how to say words incorrectly in your own language, and then you're trying to say it. Anyway, so looking back at the full journey, this was not just some, you know, one clever trick. It was a sequence of measurements and fixes across serving, memory, load generation, routing, and operations. What advice would you give to a team trying to reproduce this kind of result on their own Kubernetes platform?
Okay, so my personal take, and now putting back my Google hat, or in general hyperscaler hat. So when you're doing this kind of thing on your own Kubernetes and potentially own hardware, given how much expensive this hardware is, my personal view, but with a hyperscaler hat, I would strongly suggest to do some tests. They don't need to take months. They don't need to be extremely expensive, but do some tests in public cloud or not on-prem, because you will be able to quickly reproduce your environment or the target environment without committing massive amount of monies. Then, of course, if you want to move on-prem for all sorts of reasons, control, safety, sovereignty, old school, private cloud, whatever, TCO, yeah, makes sense. But my personal suggestion is leverage resources on one of the cloud provider, whether one of the major ones or minor ones, to actually reproduce the environment. So this concept is very much of a kind of an engineering thingy, but reproducibility, the environment, the solution, the prototype, the MVP that you're trying to test, try to make it as reproducible as possible with all sort of tricks. So infrastructure as a code, it's one of those, everything under Git. But not just that, like make sure that there are no obvious mistakes. Double check with an agent, double check with anti-gravity or cloud code or codex. I mean, leverage something to make sure that everything is done properly, or even reach out to your kind of representative at the public cloud, how they would approach this. But yeah, that would be my kind of approach.
All right. And what's next for you? What can we expect next from you, Federico?
Okay, so at the beginning, I kind of lied. You asked me, Bart, which ones are my three top Kubernetes projects I'm keeping an eye on, and I mentioned Dynamo and LLMD. And I'm very much looking at those, reading documentation, release notes, checking bugs or features. But it's not that simple to find actually some use cases for those. So definitely the next thing I'm planning to work on soon-ish is to work with either Dynamo or LLMD in a kind of a real context, and not just writing for the sake of writing, but more of kind of customer driven. That is for sure my next step. And I believe that it could result in really interesting discoveries also and ways of improving even further inference at scale.
And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Okay, so I check as much as I do no inbox policy, I also do no notification policy. So I kind of read an answer to everything. So either on LinkedIn, so look for my name, and probably Bart, you're gonna put my link on in the description, or on Medium directly. LinkedIn is slightly more business. Medium is it's way more technical. It's where I post. It's where I'm mostly active from when I write things. So yeah you can see all my work there.
Fantastic. Well, like as you just mentioned, it definitely worked in our case, reaching out to you through LinkedIn. Medium is also a great place to do it. Most of all, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us and our audience. I'm sure people are going to gain a lot of knowledge from this, and we'll probably have further questions about how they can implement some of the things that you mentioned when they're facing similar challenges in their work. I hope we can have you back on the podcast in the future. In the meantime, take care and be well. Cheers.
Thank you so much.
Tuned in to Kube FM.